in nearly two decades as a cop, as a homicide detective, and now as a crimes against children detective, I've seen a lot and I've done a lot. This podcast is not about me, though. It's about the dedicated detectives and law enforcement leaders who every single day are doing outstanding work all across this great nation. Let's reopen some of these cases with those involved to get an inside look at their investigations. You are listening to episode one of the Case Reopened podcast with Detective Scott Hodgins. I'm your host, Scott Hodgins. Good afternoon. On 11/16/14, at approximately 0204 hours, Baton Rouge Police Uniform Patrol officers were dispatched to 4700 block of Bennington Avenue in reference to a shooting at this location. Upon arrival, they located the victim, Juan Joseph, who was still conscious at the time. He was then transported to Our Lady Lake Regional Medical Center, where he later died due to his injuries. Homicide detectives were notified, and they responded. I, Detective Hodgins, along with Detective Ballard and Detective Williams, responded to the scene. Detective Ballard went to the hospital, while myself and Detective Williams went to the scene. Crime scene investigators were also present and documented the scene with photographs as well as a collection of evidence. The coroner's office took possession of Joseph's body from the hospital, and the investigation into the murder of Juan Joseph began at that time. This episode, we will be talking about a case I'm very familiar with. Here with me today is my old partner and mentor during my time in the homicide division. He has deservingly worked his way up and is now the commander of the Baton Rouge Police Department's homicide division. Most importantly, though, he's a good friend of mine, Lieutenant Brian Ballard. Brian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Scott. How's it going?
Good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Friday afternoon. Just settling in after putting out a few fires and here talking to you.
There's nothing like Friday afternoon when you're sitting in the office. So tell me a little bit about yourself. How long have you been in law enforcement?
So I started in 1996 as a reserve with the sheriff's office. While I was at LSU, I kind of got this. It just was something I really didn't have an idea that I was doing once I got into it. But once I got into law enforcement, after that, I was hooked. So shortly after graduating LSU, I started with the Baton Rouge Police in 1999. So I've been there for 25 years. I started in patrol, did about 7 years there, and have been here for the last 17 years with the homicide division. And I started as a detective, just working cases. Eventually was promoted to a sergeant, where I was over part of a squad of about six or seven guys. And now within the last couple of years, I have been promoted to the lieutenant. And so I'm over the entire division. Over the course of my career, I've also been a part of the SWAT team on the tactical side. And currently I'm a negotiator for the SWAT team. But I've been here for 25 years. I've enjoyed pretty much every day. So I don't know how many people can say that they enjoy doing what they do every day, but I really do. Some days are better than others, but you know how that goes, Scott.
Yeah. I mean, it's very interesting because you never know. Every day is different. You never know what you're going to get that day. You never know what's going to pop up. So it's always, pretty interesting to see how your day can, or you think you're going to do this thing or that thing on this day. And then all of a sudden a call comes out or a homicide comes out and guess what? Your plans for that day have completely changed, and now you have to shift gears and go in a different direction. So it's always interesting to kind of see how that plays out sometimes. So I know we've talked about this before. In your estimation, how many homicide scenes do you think you've been a part of between being a primary detective, a secondary detective, or just an assisting detective?
You know, we've worked years that we've had, 60, 70, 80 murders a year. We worked years where we've had 130. Since we respond to not only homicides, suicides, overdoses, things like that, I would say well over 1,000 crime scenes resulting in a death, probably in the, several hundreds of homicide scenes, but death scenes in general, probably a couple thousand and maybe up to 1,000 homicide scenes, more than likely.
Yeah, it's really incredible that you you think back on your career and that you've been a part of that many homicide or death scenes. And you would think you've seen it all, but just when you say that, something new pops up, and you know, yeah, I hadn't seen this before. So it's amazing how that happens.
That's why I can't stand working behind a desk. My background, when I was at LSU, I studied IT. And this is so far removed from that, just going out and just seeing what am I going to get into? What am I going to get into in my 10-hour day?
Yeah. 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 It's amazing. It's amazing. It's the front seat to life, and it's incredible. So on 11/16/2014, we received a call about this, shooting, there on Bennington Avenue. Tell me what you kind of remember about that initial call.
I remember getting woke up by one of the detectives that originally responded to the scene that was in major assaults. They got called out there because, like you said previously, he had originally was not deceased after the shooting and was transported. So another detective division did respond to that scene. They got there and quickly learned that he had passed away from his injuries, and they called us. And I just remember, you know, like every other call out from 2 o'clock in the morning, you're just hoping to make through your day a call out. But unfortunately we did not in this case, and just kind of getting the phone call, calling you, me and you kind of hashing out, hey Scott, what you want to do? Hey, I'm going to take the scene. Okay. Me and you go here, go there. I think Ross ended up going with you, detective, or he was a Sergeant Williams at the time. Now he's a lieutenant, but I remember just kind of hashing out where we were going. So I think I got the luck of the draw, I guess, to go to the hospital, which in this case ended up kind of chaotic, but you can never tell. Sometimes you go to the hospital and that's the worst part of it. Sometimes the scene's really quiet and it could be opposite. But I just remember kind of me and you getting called, just you getting that phone call in the middle of the night, and you and I both know that phone call. You're dead asleep. The wife's over there. You're trying to be quiet. The phone rings and you're like, oh man, it's a homicide. So, you know, you run off to the other room to try to, okay, what we have and things like that. And then just remember hashing it out with you. And it's like, who's taking the scene? Who's taking the hospital? Because at that time, all we knew is that we had the two scenes.
You know, you kind of mentioned that we weren't the first division that was notified of this shooting. Can you kind of explain how the other division, which was, I believe, major assaults, kind of how that went from major assaults to homicide and kind of the difference between the two there?
Certainly, their task to respond to all non-fatal shootings, and they respond to serious shootings as well. But if it's something that death's going to be imminent, they will normally dispatch homicide. From the first reports at the scene, it seemed like that the victim at the time, Juan Joseph, had not died on scene. So more than likely uniform patrol called the major assault division just because he wasn't deceased, and they handled those cases. It was, by the time he got from the house and responded to the scene, they knew then, hey, look, we have a homicide. The good thing about that is the guys from Major Assaults now we got an extra detective, so they can help on scenes for doing canvases and talking to witnesses and things like that.
Yeah, yeah, that makes sense. So in some of these situations, you know, occasionally the homicide division would get a shooting that the victim would end up surviving. And of course, at that point, we would just go ahead and work it, and it wouldn't necessarily be a homicide. But as a rule, if it was a non-fatal shooting, major assaults would work it. If it was a fatal shooting, homicide would work it.
Right. We do a lot now that one of the guys that was in there with us, Lieutenant Joe Dargin, he worked with us for years in homicide. He's over that division. So him and I have worked together. We went to the academy together. We've been buddies for 25 years. So it's a constant discussion between the two of us over cases that we've had. Where are they going? Does this look like this one may end up being deceased? Things like that. So yeah, that's a really good that we're housed together in the same place, because we can discuss cases back and forth. Yeah. Literally daily.
Yeah. Makes sense. So you responded to the hospital. When you first got to the hospital, who did you see? Who'd you talk to? Kind of how did that go?
The hospital was really chaotic. This was a shooting that happened at a nightclub. A lot of times, and you have friends and family of people that are hanging out with them at these nightclubs, they're responding, they're following wherever the victim's going. So all of these people from the nightclub ended up at the hospital. So we had to kind of weed through a bunch of people there that were at the club that were friends with this whole group. One of the people that I try to see, oftentimes when I go to the hospital, I'm not really talking to people yet. I'm going through, I'm making it to the trauma area so I can talk to the nurses and the doctors and those folks, just so I can make sure, hey, what's the status of our victim? What are we looking for? I'm going to make sure that he doesn't have any evidence or something that may need on his person. That wasn't the case in this one. We know he sustained a gunshot wound. And there wasn't a whole lot of evidence. We knew that there wasn't a fight. So I didn't need to go in there and try to process his hands or try to protect his hands to preserve any type of DNA or anything like that. So once I kind of made my way and started learning about the status of where he was at, and I then went back into like the little catch area, the waiting room, which is massive in the local hospital, and was able to find his parents. That was Mr. Greg Joseph and Miss Elizabeth, along with his wife, Kayla.
Do you remember what you told Mr. Joseph?
Oh yeah. I told him, of course, every time that you find a parent, I'm a parent, you're a parent, and you can't be disingenuous. We're parents. If this happened to us, how would we feel? I express our condolences. And sometimes people take that many different ways, but mine are heartfelt because I have never lost a child, but I've seen it happen hundreds of times. And I wouldn't wish that on my worst enemy. But I did tell him oftentimes, I said, we're going to work as hard as we possibly can to find out who did this to your son. We told him a lot. I was very honest with him and said, look, a lot of times I'm going to try to get you all the answers I can. I may not be able to put the person responsible or persons responsible in jail as fast as we want to, but at least let us dig in this investigation, and I'm going to try to get you all the answers and try to get justice for your son.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's a lot of different factors that go into, of course, whether the case ends up getting solved or not. So, and for instance, I went to the crime scene there, and there wasn't a whole lot of evidence there. We, of course, did our initial canvas. We did not find any video recordings. I think we were able to locate a couple of shell casings. No witnesses were located by the time we got out there. So we didn't have a whole lot to go by on the initial crime scene.
No, we didn't.
And so, and you, I believe at the hospital, spoke to two different people that were there with Juan on scene.
Yep, I did. Once I got and spoke with his parents, they kind of directed me to two of his buddies that were there with him. That was when we ran across Mr. Patrick Jackson and William Griffin. They were our two friends of Juan's who were with him at the nightclub, amongst other people, but those were the two main guys that were with him that night. So we were able to get them, separate them from that crowd. And then they came with us and came back to our office late in the middle of the night and talked to you and I. And that's when we kind of got the whole rundown of that case from the two of them. No one else out there was really at the hospital, really saw everything, but those two individuals were able to kind of give us an idea of what we were looking for when it comes to working the scene, what some of the suspects look like, what some of the vehicles look like, things like that. It was these two guys that were able to give us some of that information.
Yeah. And of course it was by the time we got them back to the office, we'd done our kind of scene investigation. You kind of finished up at the hospital. It was 4 or 5 AM by the time we got them back to the office and started talking to them. So obviously it'd been a long day for all of us. But in the middle of the night like that, or early morning hours, we're trying to get some answers here to paint a picture of what all occurred, to at least give us something to go by. Now kind of what were their conditions when you spoke to them?
They were obviously upset. These were young guys that had gone out to a nightclub at night. So, a lot of time they and just witnessed a traumatic event to one of their friends. So they were kind of all over the place. And I remember me and you having a talk to a couple of them. They were very animated, specifically one of the guys. I mean, he was very upset, and we just kind of had to settle him down because his emotions had him all over the place. That was, I just remember going, man, come on, he's our main witness. I hope he doesn't get so upset that we're having to just have to restrain him or something like that, because he was very animated at the scene, and definitely back again at the hospital. And I just remember him just kind of being a little bit, we had to kind of rein him in that interview that we had with him, as from my recollection.
Yeah, absolutely. He was kind of all over the place with our initial investigation, and we kind of didn't know, you know, where we were going with him. However, I think the other witness was a little bit more pointed, was a little bit more helpful. He was obviously upset, but I think we were able to get some decent information out of him as far as what happened. Can you kind of talk about the initial statement of what happened out there?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you're dealing with individuals that are at a nightclub, alcohol is going to be a factor. You know, we're just trying to calm everybody down. But what they were telling us is that they were leaving the nightclub. A lot of times, you know, Baton Rouge, you know, Louisiana, for all I know, but I know definitely in Baton Rouge, nightclubs end at 2 o'clock in the morning, everybody out. This shooting occurred at 2:03, 2:04, I think is when it first came out. So they kind of gave us the normal rundown. And most of the nightclubs around here, what are you going to have at the end of the night? You're going to have all the good looking ladies walking out. And so, you know, there's just a lot of people congregating outside. You know, there might be some people trying to leave, some people, cars pulling out. It's just kind of a hodgepodge of a whole bunch of things happening. Sounds like, from what we're understanding from our two witnesses, they're walking out and they come across this other group or another car that are pulling out or walked in front of them. And they just kind of get into a verbal argument with the people inside of you. And that's kind of where it was at. And this was this was not Juan Joseph getting into the argument with these folks. These are some other individuals. And Juan comes in here trying to de-escalate and be a peacemaker. He's a football coach. He's respected back home in his community. He's just an all-around good guy. He's trying to stop this, whatever is about to go down. He's trying to stop it from happening. And that's pretty much the rundown that they gave us when we were talking to them. Some of them a little bit better than the other ones. But the main story was that Juan came in and tried to kind of de-escalate the situation.
Yeah, I remember, obviously we didn't know a whole lot about Juan initially, but we, you know, came to find out that, yes, he was trying to be the peacemaker. He's trying to de-escalate the situation. He was not one to go out there and start fights or anything like that. And honestly, he wasn't one that was out at these clubs very often. He was kind of just at the wrong place at the wrong time. I think they were out celebrating a birthday, and I think he had a baby on the way. So they kind of figured, you know, this will be the last time in a long while that they'll able to go, they'll be able to go out and do something like this. So they just happened to go out that night and they ran into the wrong couple guys.
Yeah, they gave us a pretty good accounting of what was happening. He described some people in a vehicle. They couldn't tell how many, but definitely a driver. When one of our individuals was talking to the driver of this car and there were some exchanging some words, Juan is talking to a passenger. At some point, this passenger steps out of the car and for whatever reason, he shoots Juan in the chest. And they rapidly get back in the car and they take off. And that's kind of through one of the main busier streets in Baton Rouge. So we knew that, you know, while we're not having a whole lot of information forthcoming with a lot of the folks that were in the parking lot, we have an opportunity to potentially find some video, find something like that. Maybe we can get a better vehicle description, things like that. But they were really able to hammer down the two of those guys, the timeline of they were leaving the club. They start talking to somebody. They were very specific about the passenger getting out of the vehicle. So we knew it wasn't the driver, but they kind of pointed us in a direction. We kind of really didn't have a whole lot that night, but that was the jumping off.
Yeah, I think we kind of had a basic description of the vehicle. that we were able to later go find surveillance video. There was a Shell gas station down the street that we were able to pull video from, as well as some of the traffic cameras in that area. We were able to pull video and identify, at the time, a vehicle of interest, but we didn't know who was driving the car. We didn't know who the car belonged to. We didn't have a license plate number or anything like that. We just had a general description of what was a black Mercedes CLS vehicle. But like I said, we didn't know who the vehicle belonged to. And obviously there's more than one black CLS in Baton Rouge. So we really didn't have much more than that at that point.
Right. I just remember after the initial interviewing of the witnesses, it kind of was slow, but only briefly, because I remember me and you went back out early that next day to do another canvas outside because we did look through the parking lot in the dark. Now we wanted to go through the light. We did find an additional shell casing when we went back out there. And then it seemed like that next day is when all that information that you and I started gathering started kind of really flowing in at that point. It was, they started naming some anonymous information on these particular two individuals. And that's when we came across the Kendrick and Lamarck cloud. We were able to, at that point, kind of start digging more into them and realize that Lamarck was known to drive a black Mercedes. So we knew that from the descriptions on the scene, from the car description and that, this is a very viable lead. And that's, I remember that once me and you got kind of sunk our teeth into that, we started really rolling because that night, I think we had some search warrants.
Yeah, we did. We were able to kind of identify Lamarck at that point as a person of interest. I believe we were able to present photographic lineups between with Lamarck Cloud in one and Kendrick Cloud in the other. And we presented those to the two witnesses, Patrick and William. I know that Patrick identified Lamarck as the driver of the vehicle. Is that correct?
I believe so. Yeah. Lamarck was Patrick. Patrick was kind of more on that side of the vehicle. He was able to tell us, hey, this is the guy that I saw.
Yeah, I believe that's correct.
I'm trying to remember exactly how it went down.
That sounds about right. And then Kendrick was in the lineup that William observed. And mm-hmm. and William picked Kendrick out of the lineup as the shooter, which made sense once we kind of started thinking about things. Said, okay, he is Lamarck's cousin. They are known to hang out together, and now we have a witness identifying Kendrick as being in the vehicle. So. It made perfect sense that, hey, this guy was involved.
Right. So pretty much none of the information that we were getting at that time pointed to anybody other than those two individuals. We were able to, based on that information, we found that Lamarck lived in an address right around the street from the office. So we did serve a search warrant that night and hit his house with a SWAT team. We were able to do all that, get a search going with that, contacted Lamarck and brought him back to our office. He declined to give a statement though.
Yeah. And while we were setting up to do the search warrant, we were doing surveillance on the residence, if you remember right. And
oh, yeah.
The vehicle in the driveway was a black Mercedes-Benz CLS.
Yep, it was driven by one of his family members, and I don't think that they knew that we were set up down the road. It was just happenstance that these individuals were leaving in this car. And we're like, holy cow, because we didn't see that car, from what I can recall, when we first went over to the house. We just were going to do an arrest warrant on Lamarck, and with the evidence that we had, got arrest warrants on both these individuals and found this was his address. We knew that he was known to have a vehicle like that, but we didn't see one on our original pass with checking out the area. But it was great that one of the detectives that was working on the scene was like, hey man, I just got a Mercedes running down the road. I'm like, oh boy, we're in it now. So they were able to call in uniform patrol and stop that vehicle and contact a family member. And when we did that, she pretty much confirmed that that's the vehicle, that's that was a family member, that Lamarck was a family member of hers and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. And so we served that search warrant at that residence, and unfortunately, we didn't come up with much.
Nothing.
So good. Yeah, yeah. So following that, Lamarck came in, like you said, and he declined to make a statement. He lawyered up. So obviously that didn't help a whole lot there.
No.
But the investigation continued.
It did continue. That was really the second day of the investigation. That was the 17th day of November. So here we are. We start off November 16th at 2 a.m. We got nothing. It's on the 17th. We're over here hitting houses with search warrants and pulling out suspects, which was awesome. Problem is, other than word of mouth and some eyewitness information, not a whole lot of supporting evidence. And that's when we ran into who I would just call Mr. Anonymous, if you recall that guy. Because that kind of sticks out. And I've told people before, I've never done that before, which when we met this anonymous witness downtown in Baton Rouge.
Yeah, so we got a tip from state police that they had an anonymous informant that wanted to speak to us about the situation. And so we set it up to meet with the guy downtown in the back of a car. Of course, when we first spoke to him, we searched him and made sure he didn't have any weapons or have any ulterior motive.
Think I did.
Yeah, yes.
I hope he did his job good because he's about to tell us some stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. But do you remember what he told us?
He said, "Hey, look, I know that there was a search warrant hitting that house. Y'all need to go check the woods." And he was also able to say that there was like a J mark or something that he believed that was involved as well. But he said, definitely over there where y'all hit that search warrant, y'all need to go check the wooded area, which was maybe one house down from where the house was. And so, of course, as soon as this guy, Mr. Anonymous, and I still have no idea who he is to this day, as soon as he leaves, Scott and I jet out to this area at the dead end of Melrose, where there is a extremely wooded area. We bring everything that we need that we're going to need in a vehicle. I mean, in a area search, we bring extra detectives. We actually called in the canines to see if we can do an article search. The canines couldn't find anything, but I had canine Scott Hodgins with me, and he sniffed out a plastic bag near the trunk of a tree. And he's like, "Hey, I think I got something over here." And I'm thinking, no, there's no way. He didn't get it. The dog missed it. We're just doing this. We're just running through the hoops at this point. Well, sure enough, Scott and when we had crime scene there as well, when we start tugging on this bag, there's something heavy in it. And it turns out to be a weapon, which was immensely important as we progress through this case. Because now, not only do we have some ballistic evidence at the scene, we also have a potential weapon that was recovered from a wooded area next to the house of a guy that we just hit a search warrant on that was a prime suspect.
Yeah, I mean, I remember doing the article search looking for this gun that, in a wooded area, we kind of figured this, okay, this is going to be a needle in a haystack. But that's why we brought the canine out to see if the canine would sniff anything out. We got finished with that little article search. And, I kind of stayed in the woods for a second, just kind of kicking some leaves around. I might get lucky. And I just happened to see that white plastic bag that came from a convenience store. And I was kind of near a tree. And the bag kind of looked fresh, as opposed to a bag that had been sitting in the wooded area for a long time. Naturally it caught my attention. But I thought, it's a little too obvious, to be anything. But sure enough, I walked up to it and was able to kind of peek inside. And sure enough, there's the gun. And of course, when I told people that, hey, I got the gun here, everybody thought, oh, I just unholstered my gun, laid it on the ground, and, was making a joke out of it. But I said, no, this is... I got the gun here. And like you said, it was a huge key part of a key piece of evidence for the case. that really, really helped us focus in on the prime suspect.
Yeah, I mean, now we have a weapon. Now we have something that we can test. Now that we have some things that we will be able to use later on in this investigation to be able to, you know, show the jury how much we're doing. Because ultimately, our goal is not to arrest someone. My goal anytime I have a homicide investigation is to not only arrest, but to convict this person of the charges that we charge them with. That's why we're detailed as we are. That's why we write all the copious amounts of reports that we do. It's to not only get an arrest, because that's just the beginning of it. And that was kind of where we were with this. The arrest of Lamarck was just the beginning of it. Now we're finding the gun. Now we're hearing from the same guy who now we know has really detailed information, because he's telling, some stranger is telling us about a gun in the woods.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We find the gun in the woods. He also told us about J Mark. So now we're thinking, well,
out of Houston.
Yeah. Who's J Mark? Because this guy was 100% right on the weapon. So now what are we going to do? We need to find out who this guy is. And we do some digging, and it just so happens that, like, around the same time, we also get some Crime Stoppers tips. They're anonymous tips phoned in through our Crime Stoppers program, and they named a person by the name of Jamarcus Goodman. So really similar to a J Mark. So we thought, well, holy cow, we're on top of something right now. This anonymous guy is giving this. We're getting tips in now that this is going to be this particular individual. We need to find out how he fits into this case.
Yeah, absolutely. And we made some phone calls to, I believe, Houston police to see if they could give us some information on this guy, as we, you know, we learned that he was from Houston. And that's when we learned that he was wanted out of Houston for an aggravated robbery. So Houston police themselves were looking for the guy, and the as well as the Marshals Task Force down there. And so so we kind of exchanged some information, and they said they'd let us know if they found him, and we would do the same if we found him in Baton Rouge.
Right. We have these two guys in jail, but now we have this J Mark. That's called exculpatory evidence. We would not be given our due diligence if we don't go back and look at every piece of evidence we have. This is the only other person that was mentioned. So of course now we're going to check on this J Mark. Scott was able to, like you said, contact those individuals. And now we're kind of in this, we know we got the Baton Rouge contingency of this stuff. There's some, this Goodman fellow that's out here in Texas somewhere. And now we're kind of doing a lot of the background stuff for the investigation. That's going to be looking at video footage. It was within these couple of days, because like I said, we go from day one, nothing. Day two, hitting search warrants. Day three, we're finding guns in the woods. Now we're trying to do some background on, okay, let's go back to some of these other things. And that's when we come across some more video footage, which is confirming. So now that this very similar black Mercedes is leaving the club, we get a bunch of this information back at this time. Now we know that there's a Jamarcus Goodman. We were able to get a picture of him through our, I want to say we were able to get it through the, through one of our,
was it one of our analysts?
Word escapes me right now, but one of our analysts was able, that's it. Yeah. One of our analysts was able to get us a photograph. And this is like, okay, now we have a guy that, let's see how he fits into this. And so we're going to go find our guys, William and Patrick, to see if they can identify this person as being involved in the homicide that we're working. Yeah. Unfortunately, we spoke with them a couple of days. As soon as we found out about Goodman, we were able to put this into some lineups, and we showed it to them, but they were unable to make an identification at that time.
Yeah. Yeah. So in the meantime, what did we do with the gun?
That gun was sent to the state police crime lab. They ran various and sundry tests on it for all kind of stuff, mostly ballistic. They're going to swab it for DNA, things like that, fingerprint it. So they swabbed it, and then they test fired it. It was then confirmed that that weapon that you found in the woods was matched to the casings that we found on the scene.
And so that's when we quickly determined that, or confirmed that was the murder weapon.
Correct. And that was real, I mean, because we have a real good relationship with not only the state police, we have some guys from the Baton Rouge Police Department that are housed over there. So we kind of give it the old, let's get this rush job over here real fast. So we were able to rush it to them. They were able to get us in there real quick and start giving us some information on that weapon. So we were able to then confirm that that was in fact the weapon. Then that's kind of where we kind of go into
a little lull period.
Yeah. I mean, a little, I mean, we're looking at like, we're looking around December now and we're finding weapons and we're getting stuff back from the lab. And now we're just awaiting court dates for the Kendrick and Lamarck. And we're trying to still find this Goodman character.
Yeah.
And we're just kind of in a lull. I mean, and of course, you know, this isn't our only case. So now you kind of have to put your efforts back into some other things, but we're just kind of, my old supervisor used to say, we're just letting it simmer at this point, but we're not getting a whole bunch of new information.
Yeah. In some of that meantime, that's when I believe the case was presented to the grand jury for Lamarck and Kendrick. And Lamarck himself was indicted as it pertains to this case. However, Kendrick was, I believe, no billed. At that point, we started focusing in on Jamarcus Goodman, and we believe that Kendrick may not have been involved. So it kind of worked out there through the grand jury process. Now, during this kind of lull period, I made a little change in my career. I did leave you, unfortunately. It was kind of just a situation that worked out best for my family and I, and we made the move to Texas ourselves. And so I started working in Texas. On the second day with my new department, I received a phone call. This was from a Houston number, and this is about 6-7 months after the murder. It was a Houston number. I didn't recognize it, but I answered it. And it was somebody on the other line that said, "Hey, this is so-and-so from the Houston Police Department. Just want to let you know that Jamarcus Goodman is in custody. Do you want to come speak to him?" And I said, well, let me tell you a little funny story here. You're going to need to talk to my partner. So, of course, I got y'all in touch. And I believe you and one of the other detectives in the division went over to Houston and you spoke to Jamarcus. So how did that go?
You kind of froze up on me, buddy.
So you and somebody else from our division went over to Houston. And you ended up speaking to Jamarcus while he was in custody there. Do you remember kind of how that went?
Yeah, we actually grabbed the commander of the division at the time. It was Lieutenant Chris Polito. We went down and made a day trip to Harris County Sheriff's Office and to their detective division. Those guys were, they welcomed us in their office, let us do everything we needed to do. They actually brought Jamarcus into us. Jamarcus, Polito and I just really kind of brought him in there and started questioning him, of course, after Miranda and things of that nature. But we're starting to question him about, hey, have you ever been in Baton Rouge? Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I have. Well, where'd you hang out when you were in Baton Rouge? Oh, I hung out with some friends and kind of was like some friends of my cousin's boyfriend and things of that nature. And like, oh, where'd you hang out? And he's like, he kind of gave us the same description of where we had hit the search warrant and where we had, found the weapon. So he's telling us like he's in Baton Rouge. He tells us we kind of have to narrow it down. Like, hey, was it during football season? That things that we actually able to narrow it down finally during this lengthy conversation that he was in Baton Rouge at the time of the homicide. We directly asked him at one point in the interview, hey, I mean, were you involved? Did you go out to any nightclubs in Baton Rouge? Nope. He never went to any nightclubs, never did anything. He didn't do anything fun when he was in this great city of ours of all the football and food. And he just decided to sit at home all day long. So that's what he would have us believe. But he did at least give us that he was in town at the time of this murder. So we knew we were on the right track with him. We had a DNA warrant for him that we prepared on a little bit on our end. We're able to give to Harris County, and they were able to swab his DNA and for us to take that back to compare to anything that we had at the crime scene or taken from the scene.
Yeah, and to kind of jump ahead a little bit for time purposes, With that DNA sample, we of course tested it against the any DNA samples that we found from the gun, and of course those came up negative, or I'm sorry, inconclusive. So what do we do next?
That was where the EBR district attorney's office, specifically Katie Berrios, who was an ADA working this case, was instrumentally I can't describe how much she pushed. She was instrumental in getting this DNA worked. Let's find where we have, okay, this is inconclusive. Is there some other place that we can outsource this to that can give us a true determination that, okay, this was inconclusive. Can y'all enhance this to some degree? Can we do some additional testing of this so we can get this profile named, whoever it is? We were hoping that it was going to come back to one of our suspects, obviously, but we have a unknown sus or unconclusive sample on a weapon. We definitely want to enhance that to where we can get a name. Yeah. And that way it was her push to get that funding acquired to go get this tested by an additional outside lab that was able to help us eventually get the DNA enhanced to a point where it would give us a name of who that sample was from.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's not something you can do for every case due to, you know, the cost involved in doing that. However, we were fortunate for this case that we were able to get that done. And later on down the line, that DNA hit came back as Jamarcus Goodman.
Yeah, I literally remember sitting in the office, and I know that we got this case kind of in the background, and I just get a random call in the afternoon. And they're like, "Hey, you ain't gonna believe this." And I'm like, "What is it?" And it's a call from Katie. She goes, "The DNA profile was able to be enhanced. It's just hitting back. It's Jamarcus Goodman." And I'm like, "Holy shit, this is what happened.
We got it. We got him. At that point, you know, we got him. Yeah. Yeah. So at that point, we knew we had our guys. We were able to bring, we were able to make a deal with Lamarck based on everything we knew. So we brought him back in, or you all brought him back in, cause I was gone at that point. And you were able to get a new statement from him.
Yeah. We told him that night, we kind of felt that he knew what we were talking about. He did not want to give a statement, but he kind of made some indications of like, "Hey, look," and we already knew that he was described as coming out of the driver's side of the vehicle. So we're thinking that he's not going to be our shooter. He is potentially going to be our driver, but I'm not going to feed him this in an interview. Like, if you don't want to give me anything, I'm not going to give you like, "Hey man, let's do this." So I just want to know what you have to say. But I told him, I said, "Look, I don't know." And I told him that when we were going to jail, I said, "I can't tell you what's going on in this case, but I can tell you right now, one day, you're going to come and talk back to us about this case." And I remember telling me and you were bringing him to the Sally Port. And I told him, I said, "You're going to talk to us one day about this stuff, and you're going to be the one to come tell us about it." And that was exactly what happened in this case. He came back to us almost 2 years later. It was September of 2016 when he finally got contact through us, through an attorney, that he wanted to give an additional statement.
Yeah. And he, at that point, if I'm not mistaken, he confirmed everything that, at that point we knew, and he was able to confirm it for us. And being that we knew he was not the shooter, he was, given a better deal than, what the shooter got.
Yeah. We're not able to, you know, kind of do that as much. I know that people do, judges, folks like that do take in consideration cooperating with police. He was in jail for some additional charges, and that was something that was worked out with the DA's office and his attorneys. We just knew that he wanted to now give us a statement, and he did give us a statement. He talked about J-Mark, and J-Mark was a cousin of an ex-girlfriend at the time. So we knew these were all facts that we knew, but now here we have him, someone that we talked to the second day of this investigation, almost 2 years later, now telling us, "Hey, look, this is what you have. I can't tell you his name, but I knew him as J-Mark," which was very convenient because that was what Mr. Anonymous told us within days of the onset of this investigation.
Yeah.
So literally, I talked to him on September 20th, 2016, September 21st, 2016. I get a warrant for Jamarcus Goodman for the second degree murder of Juan Joseph.
Yes. And Jamarcus, of course, was arrested and he was later convicted. And I believe he got 40 years on this murder. Is that correct?
Yeah, he was actually in your neck of the woods. So me and one of my other partners at the time, we had to drive down to Raymondville, Texas, which is almost at the border, it felt like. And we go and talk to him because he was in jail on some additional charges. And I went and dropped that warrant on him like December 6th, 2016. We went and dropped a warrant that we had written in Baton Rouge on him. And we was like, hey, look, here's a warrant for your arrest for second degree murder. He had already seen me once before when I went to Harris County, Texas. So now we have him sitting in a facility in Texas and he's got a warrant in Baton Rouge. So what we have to do then is, again, here comes ADA Berrios. Katie was able to get a governor's warrant signed by the governor of Texas to send him back into our custody so we could bring him to trial. He was able to, it did not go to trial. For whatever reason, he took a 40-year plea as a manslaughter, and that goes in addition to whatever other cases he was, whatever other time he had in Texas. And any other additional cases weren't going to be consecutive with that. He was going to have to serve all of the time that he owed Texas and then the time that he owes Baton Rouge.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and kind of in conclusion, it's kind of amazing how sometimes these cases go from, you know, not knowing a whole lot to sometimes even years later, like in this case, to being completely solved and getting all those questions that we have throughout the investigation eventually answered. So once again, I appreciate you coming on today. Brian, I would love to have you back on the show sometime in the future with the multitude of cases that you've worked in your career. Many, many, many of those cases are very interesting. And, you know, each case is different, but similar and how they go from nothing to being solved. So, once again, thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. You know, I always answer my phone. It doesn't matter what time of day. So
I know. You've had plenty of those calls, late night calls overnight. So I promise I won't call you for the podcast, at 3 a.m. But, we'll see.
Hi, buddy.
Thanks, brother.